And here we are in winter. Why is it winter? I don't know. No, I guess I do. It's got something to do with the sun and the angle of the earth and all that jazz. But the biggest problem is, to a nature photographer, naturally, is that there isn't a damn thing to photograph. Now, most people, they think about photography, nature photography in winter, and they think things like, you know, Montana or the Yukon or Northwest Territories or something like that, I don't know. And they think, oh, snow-laden trees and, you know, wolves running around in the winter and deep snow and all this kind of stuff. And that's not the case in North Carolina. North Carolina just has mostly bare trees and patchy brown grass and not much else. There isn't a whole lot of snow to photograph, and there isn't really anything else. You know, the animals have slowed down quite a bit. You know, a lot of people will say, well, birds, you can photograph birds. There's still birds around. Well, I've never been one for photographing birds in the first place. I never really paid much attention to them. I've let other people do birds, and part of it, I think, is that every time that I'm out looking at birds or for birds, I see the same kind of sparrows and finches all the time. And I don't really care too much about songbirds and about having to get closer to them to see them with the kind of same expression. It just doesn't do anything for me. And I know you can say the same thing about insects. Well, you know, insects don't exactly change expression. Yeah, shut up. Anyway, the big thing is not my shortcomings regarding my subject matter and my chosen thing. What I'm talking about here is, what can you do in the winter, or what can you do really at any point in time when there isn't anything to photograph? And I'm here to tell you there's lots of things you can do, but, you know, truly exciting things in all this. You're not going to find a good replacement for the regular photography that you're doing. Chances are you're not going to come out with the same kind of photographs. This is a slower season. We're going to embrace that. Perhaps reluctantly, but we're going to embrace that. But what can we do in these seasons? What can we tackle? What is there? What, you know, I'm sitting here bored. I'll tell me something to do. Okay, fine, I will. Jeez. And the very first thing is, this is your time for cleaning your equipment. Oh my God, no. Did you just say cleaning your equipment? That's like for the spring. No, but seriously, this is a lot of times that we will let our equipment go for a long period of time because of that. It's boring. It's not fun. But it's a good time to sit here and be ready. And it kind of reminds you about what condition your equipment is in and what you may have to do. And I'm talking about camera equipment here. Cut it out. But a good time to also get in, clean out the bag, get the vacuum with the little crevice attachment and get in there and get all that crap out of there, because that kind of stuff can do damage to your equipment, can most especially scratch lenses. Yeah, we're putting our lens cap on a regular basis, but all it takes is one lens cap to come off when the lens gets pushed down towards the bottom of the bag, and you can get your lens scratched up pretty seriously, and you don't fix that. You replace that. You buy a new one. You don't fix that at all. And yeah, clear filter. You can put a clear filter on there. I have not had very good results with clear filters, with the UV filters. In fact, I found that they usually degrade the photos a little bit. But if you're the kind that would rather leave your bag filthy in the odd case that your lens cap comes off and things, fine, use your UV filter, go for it. But get in there and clean out everything. And one of the things I will say that I found out a very long time ago, that I was a big fan of using alcohol and cotton swabs to clean up little things. And a lot of the silk screening paints that they use around the barrels of lenses are sensitive to alcohol. And you will find that in some cases, you'll start dabbing at the lens body or the camera body with alcohol, and the painted markings that are on there are coming off after a little while. Like a few weeks later, you find that they're disappearing. So do not use alcohol. Use just warm water as much as you can. I have not found a safe solvent for anything that's on the outside of bodies, and while there may be one out there, I'm just going to say just warm water at best, and very sparing amounts. But also, this is a good time to find out what exactly the performances are on your lenses, and find out some of the details about them, because most lenses perform differently at different apertures, and you will find that even at different apertures, at different focal lengths. And so it may work fine at f8. You may get really sharp pictures at f8 at, say, 50 millimeter focal length, but then you go out to 200 millimeter and it doesn't actually have the same performance. It doesn't have the same sharpness. So it's not a bad time to sit there and figure it out and know and say, okay, if I try and do this, you know, if I'm out in the field and I want to do f8 at 200, it's not going to work as well. I probably want to go to F11 and try that instead. But you'll look for things like edge-to-edge sharpness, corner light fall-off is a big thing, and that typically happens at wide open when you're at maximum aperture. But it's a good time to do this and find out what it is and compare lenses in like the same subject matter. And there's two ways of doing this for the most accurate, and the best thing is to have something pasted on a wall like a newspaper page. Newspaper? What the hell is that? It's a page of printing, fine printing all over it, but anyway, anything like that, a book page, something consistent all the way across, consistent in light and consistent in detail, so that you can compare and say, oh, wow, you know, the center of the page I can read very nicely, but the corner of the page is getting a little blotchy or whatever. But do several different lenses when you're doing this and try and get nice, even light. The big thing, most especially with some kinds of lenses, is that you want it flat to the film plane of the camera. You want the camera back and the wall that your page is posted to, or the page itself, whatever, parallel, so that there isn't actually a different distance between the bottom of the page and the top of the page in how close it is to the camera. Another thing is ISO tests. Most cameras nowadays will have ISOs that can go up fairly high, but there hasn't been a camera body that I've seen or used recently where the maximum ISO isn't actually crap, where it is something that you really wouldn't use for photos unless in a very extreme circumstances. They keep trying to push this and say, oh, you know, you can have ISO 75,000 on this one, and you can see, you know, you can see in complete and utter darkness in the space between stars, whatever. I don't know what you're, you know, what you're trying to use it for. That's your bag. But most of the time when you have these, they don't really perform well at all. They look terrible at your maximum ISO. So this is a good time to do the ISO test and find out what your usable maximum ISO is for the kind of pictures you shoot and for your demands. You may not be as demanding as I am. You may be far more demanding than I am. You probably are. Who knows? But for ISO tests, the big thing is to find a subject, a little bit of a range of colors, but mostly you want gradient tones. You do not want the detail that you see, for instance, in a you know, photographing a newspaper page. I explained what that is earlier. Go on. You want something that is actually going to show a general transition between colors and between shades. So when I say gradient tones, I'm saying something that shows a gradual transition of into shadow. Curved surfaces are really good about this. You know, you go into downtown on a sunny day and you find those sculptures that are sitting in front of some particular building, and you use those sculptures, you know, the geometric shapes or whatever. But something like that, to where you have the light going around them, because it's these gradient tones on surfaces and gradient tones in the sky that are going to show you where the ISO is failing, where it starts getting blotchy. You want some low light in there because that's going to show you where you get ISO noise. But typically ISO noise comes up in long exposures where the shutter is open for a while and is trying to do reading of very, very faint voltages through the CCD, the sensor, or the CMOS sensor, whatever you like. And that's kind of hard to combat. You're going to run into that in long exposures no matter what. Some cameras are much worse than others. Some cameras have ways to actually get rid of that noise and do long exposure noise. And this isn't a bad time to do that test as well. But also, pull out your camera manual or download it again if you need to. Most of them are online. I can tell this from experience, from having students, is that I can find just about every camera manual online. And look in there for the esoteric functions. Again, with students, I have a lot of them that say, well, what does this do? I don't know. I look at this thing and it's so complicated. And modern digital camera bodies offer a tremendous amount of things. They're trying to be everything to everybody, so they offer a tremendous amount of options. And you'll find that you can safely ignore them. Look at them and say, okay, what is this supposed to do? And if it doesn't ring any bells to you, if it doesn't sound like something that you've ever tackled, then don't worry about it. Ignore it. Skip past it. It is either something that applies to photography that you don't do, or it is a technique that's a little bit more advanced than what you've been tackling right now, and you may come back to it later on. But this is also the time when you come back to it, and you go back and take a look. You know, we're sitting here in the winter, so dig out the camera manual and look at this and go, oh, I never realized this. This would work in this situation. Okay. But take a look, try and find some of the esoteric functions that say, oh, well, here's how you do this, and go, let me try that out. I want to see how this works. I want to see what it does. Because there's an awful lot of things that are on there that they will tell you, oh, this is useful in this situation. And maybe it's really great in that situation, and it's a really big help. But I found for the most part, an awful lot of those things are okay in very specific circumstances or in a very narrow range of conditions. And an awful lot of the advanced functions or the fancy functions that are on cameras, I just ignore. You don't need them if you have a good understanding of photography. A lot of these are just shortcuts. And on a lot of the cameras, you'll have the lettered modes, which have, you know, like P and S and V, P and S and A and M. Or on Canon, for some stupid reason, they have the TV and AV on there. And these are the modes I suggest shooting in, because they give you known results and controls. And then you'll have all these other modes, which will be, you know, sports mode and macro mode and landscape mode and all this. And they all have a little icon. They all have a little picture. And I call them the ducky horsey modes. And I tell people to leave them alone. And what they're intended to do is to try and make things easier for you. But if you don't know what they're doing, they don't necessarily make things easier for you. Because then when you don't get the results that you wanted, and you go to take a landscape photo and you're in landscape mode and landscape photo comes up crap, you don't know why, and you're just going, this mode doesn't work. I say stay away from, but there's a few things. Like auto exposure bracketing is built into an awful lot of cameras, and you can set this function to, A, have a certain amount of bracketing space that it does, a certain amount of pictures that it takes, and B, a certain degree of over and under exposure. And I do tell people to, you will need to use exposure compensation, not on a regular basis, but in certain circumstances it's going to help. And the big problem with auto exposure bracketing is that you often, A, you have to have it set for what's going to be useful for you, and then you have to be able to get to it easily. And most people don't remember where it is, and then they have to sit there and start playing around with the menu. But in some cases, on your custom functions on the camera, you can set a particular button on the camera to automatically bring up auto exposure bracketing. Sometimes it's the menu button or the set button or something like that. But so right in the middle of shooting, you hit this button and it says, hi, I'm ready to auto expose bracket. I don't even know if that's a phrase or if that's how the phrase should be. Anyway, the camera doesn't say anything to you. It just pops up the menu and says, and you know, says, and displays words to the effect of, it is ready to go. And then you can just hold the camera steady and trip the shutter and let it fire off its multiple shots at different exposures so that you can pick the one that has the exposure that you like, that gets the shadow detail that you like, or that gets the highlight detail that you like. Like one example that I have is photographing flowers, especially white flowers, but also snow. Again, it's winter. Hey, there are very, very faint, subtle differences in the gradient tones in the white surface, and you don't want to bleach them all out to white. You want just enough detail for them to appear bright, but still have those shadows and shapes. That's one. The other one is sunset, big time, sunrise, sunset pictures. The amount of color ranges that are in there and the amount of detail that may be captured will definitely take some, almost always, not every time, will take some exposure compensation. And having that automatic bracketing that you can pop up and fire off 5 or 6 shots, and better than 3, seriously, better than 3 for such a thing. But also, you'll want to know how to do this by hand. And so that's another thing. If you don't know how to do this, this is, you find it out in your manual, you practice it, you learn how to do this. Now, there are some other things, like for instance, you've seen a particular effect. And for one, oh, let's just say the cottony water waterfall effect. And you want to know how to do that, and you want to know how that works. Well, okay, look it up online. Somebody is going to tell you how to do this online. There's probably a YouTube video about it. There's probably an unboxing the cottony water effect video of it. I hate unboxing videos. But anyway, you can look it up online. You can study what people say about it. Moon photography, big one. Oh, how do I get a good picture of the moon? I keep getting, every time I take a picture of the moon, it's all blown out white and blurry and all this. Well, there are specific ways of doing it, and you can find them online that'll tell you how to do it. There's also do-it-yourself projects that you may find for particular equipment. I've been a big fan of do-it-yourself since I've been unbelievably poor. No, that's part of it, but a lot of it is I'm looking for something that does a very specific task. And I've looked sometimes for a long time, even just my camera bags. I want a certain kind of camera bag, and they don't make that big a variety of them. But I've been a big fan of learning how to make what I need, what it's going to produce, the results that I'm looking for. And that even, you'll see this, in fact, I'll probably have a link to one of the projects, which is making the soft boxes for the macro work that I do, because I want it spread out to a certain degree, but I want to be able to position it where I need it. So this is a good time to tackle do-it-yourself projects and to try and find people that have done the same thing, or just start, you know, you may have to start experimenting and figure out, and you make a first edition of something and say, oh, here's the shortcomings, I didn't think about this. Or I didn't realize that using this particular material or these methods of holding things together wouldn't work or wouldn't last very long. And so you do your first version and then you go, oh, let's do the upgraded version, the Mark II. In this climate, in this area, in North Carolina, this is a good time for night sky shots to a degree. And the primary thing is that it's very humid in this state. And in the winter, the humidity goes away. Well, humidity in the sky is what gives you haze. And at night, a lot of times, so if you're doing starry shots, you don't realize it. But the haze will reduce the amount of light that's being transmitted from the moon and the stars, and will also bounce light from the ground, from, you know, light pollution. So winter is when the humidity drops real low and the skies get much clearer. So it's a good time to do night sky shots. This may or may not apply to the area you're in, but most cases the humidity reduces in the winter. But this does mean, of course, if you're doing night sky shots and you're doing long exposures, that you are out in the cold, and usually much colder than even during the day, and you're freezing your butt off. So I say this is a good time to do night sky shots, and it depends on how much of a badass you are and how much you can tolerate. It also depends on how much your camera can tolerate. The big thing that I have found with the lithium-ion batteries is that their power curve drops rapidly when they get cold, and those batteries will go dead. And you say, but I just put fresh batteries in here. I've been out 20 minutes and they're dead. I've done 3 exposures. I don't understand this. Well, it's just that the batteries just can't. The chemical reaction that takes place in them becomes much slower and much less effective in the cold, and the batteries go dead. And the funny thing is that you'll warm the batteries back up, and they will come back up to speed. They're not actually dead. They're not discharged. They just can't react. They can't produce the power that they're trying to do. I keep personifying these things. The chemical reaction slows down, and it is no longer producing the power curve that they once had. They are happy? Fine. So you will run into this, and you will want to have at least one spare set of batteries that you can swap out. And an inside jacket pocket is a good thing to drop the other batteries into and warm them back up. And then you may be able to trade batteries back and forth a few different times that night in order to get some night sky shots. But anything that you can do to try and keep the camera warmer in that time, like wrapping it in some kind of, you know, bundling it up in something that obviously don't cover the lens unless that's the kind of night sky shots you want to do, but I don't think that's going to work. But bundle it up to try and keep the batteries as warm as possible to keep the cold from getting to them. One of the things about winter is that things can become stark. Now, I'm a transplant from Central New York, and New York generally meant that winter, a very large percentage of winter days were overcast all the time. A very, very dreary place in the winter. And again, people, oh, New York winters. New York winters, you know, when you get a sunny or a fairly bright day, but a heavy overcast just casts a pall and a gloom over everything. In fact, those two words are required to be used when talking about winter photography in some of the states. And there wasn't much to see. Even when you had a heavy snow, it just was so deep and dark and dreary that it didn't look very well. And this is one of the nicer things about North Carolina, is that you get many more sunny days in North Carolina during the winter than you do, than I did in New York at the very least, but certainly in a lot of the northern states. And what this does, you also have stark subjects. You have the trees that don't have leaves, and you end up getting into some high contrast light conditions, much more so than normal. And so this is a time to get into black and white. Black and white works from contrast. Black and white gives you your best effect if you have high contrast conditions. This is not a bad time to start experimenting with it and to work with it, because you'll find those bare trees against the sky, and maybe the gradient tones of the sky, or maybe a couple of little clouds up there. But this is a good time to start experimenting with it and start messing around. Most cameras will have a monochrome function to shoot in. I suggest staying away from that. Instead, shooting in full color. And then you can convert to monochrome back in an editing program, or you can do the channel clipping method, which I've outlined, I'll have a link to, But it's, I think it's better to go ahead and shoot in full color. And you have a full color shot. And you also have, if something interesting happens, you don't have to sit there and start messing around with the camera to convert it from monochrome back to color to get the, you know, the pileated woodpecker that suddenly appeared in front of you or what have you. Now, of course, this is also a time to catch up. And I hate saying this because this is, you know, I'm trying to give you good ideas and not, yeah, I already knew that I was avoiding this. But this is a good time to sort your photos. And by sorting, I mean into a functional, useful way. An awful lot of times, like for instance, you'll unload your photos into your computer and they will be in, for instance, date folders or something like that, which is the most absolutely worthless way of sorting photos, as far as I'm concerned. Because we don't look, we don't have a memory and we go, oh yeah, that heron that was flying past, I shot that on January 12th. No, nobody looks at things like that. So it all depends on what exactly you want to do. You're going to make your own categories. But most times what works better is having categories of very specific things like birds and mountains and beach. Something along, you know, whatever works for you. I have a ton of different folders. And there's a few things that kind of go all together, like leaves, plants, and trees. I do too many of those, but I will, you know, they all go together into one kind of big thing. I don't differentiate leaves from trees or something like that. And fungus gets in there, even though technically I don't think it counts as a plant. I don't know. Who cares? But anyway, this is a good time to sort and get the things together, because if and when somebody comes to you, and especially if you're trying to be serious about this, but if and when somebody comes to you and says, do you have any pictures of such and such? You don't want to pick through every dated folder to find this. You want to be able to narrow this down to a fair degree and find what you're looking for. And even better, and this is the really tedious part, I hate saying this, but this is something that's useful. And this is part of, again, if you want to be serious, you have to do all the pieces that you need to be serious. It's not just the fun and the glamour of being out there in the mud taking pictures. But you'll want to have a database that lets you find things, and you learn how to do a searchable database. So you have, for instance, the image number, and then it says, Great Blue Heron, Ardea herodias. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that right. That's the Latin name for great blue herons. Having the Latin names for things does help a lot, I will say. That's another thing I'm going to talk about in an upcoming podcast. But that's another database field that I have. And then I'll have maybe, you know, horizontal, vertical, have the date that it was actually taken, the location that it was taken. And then a couple little odds and ends that I will put in, like if there's a particular item of interest or if there's a primary color that's in the photo itself, like most of the background was blue or green, especially if it's a really deep, rich color. A lot of times I will note this because when doing artistic purposes or accent photo purposes, that it kind of helps and goes, I need a blue picture here. And so I'll throw that in there just for giggles. But of course, this does mean that you're sitting down with every photo and you're adding all this information in. Now, the nice thing about most databases, and when I say database, you can get a database program, but of course, all you need is a spreadsheet. Lay out the spreadsheet in the details that you want, and of course, the most used things towards the front. But learn how to do a sort on any column in the spreadsheet so that you can narrow it down and say, just give me the great blue herons. This is not a hard thing to do. Again, you can find out how to do this online. But when somebody calls you and wants a particular photograph or wants to know if you have ever captured a photograph like this, you do not have to look through every one of your photographs. And this is huge on insects, let me tell you. This can be a very tedious thing. But you don't have to look through every one of your photographs to say, yes, I've got that. You actually can do it sometimes on the phone and say, well, hang on one second. Ah, yeah, there we go. I have that. I don't know if the keyboard sounds came through or not on that one. And I just realized I typed over something that I didn't want. Anyway, but this is the time to do it. Now, here's a great use. Here's a very good thing to do for this kind of timing, is to plan your trips. You know, for instance, you're going to take a trip out to, like, I know that there are two primary trips that are lined up for this year and a probable third. And the two primary trips are going to be going out to Topsail Island because we actually have a vacation house out there. And Jekyll Island, once again, a savanna area, I should say. And I do know that those two are going to take place and about when they're going to take place. So I can sit there and say, all right, first of all, give me a list of the sunrise and sunset times for those days that I'm going to be out there so that I have that handy. Maybe you put it in your phone or whatever, but have it handy so that it's there. know what the phase of the moon is going to be like, what the light conditions are going to be there. No, for instance, take a look at some maps and see, for instance, where the beach, which direction is going to be facing into the sun or away from the sun or whatever on the beach. And just kind of give an overall, sit down and think about all this information and have it on hand so that when you're there and a full moon comes out or you want to catch moonrise out over the water, you know when it's going to occur, you know what direction it's going to occur, you know which beach to get to. So this is a good time to sit there and familiarize yourself with this. And you get the online maps up, and most especially the online satellite photos. Usually they're not satellite. Most times they're just aerial photographs, but everybody wants to think they're satellite photographs. But anyway, pull up the online photographs in Google Maps or whatever you want to use, and take a look around, skim around, look at the area. All of a sudden you're going to see something and say, hey, there's this weird little pond in the middle of the woods. Where is this? What is this? Can I get to it? And you'll see some items of interest, and you'll know where to go. You'll see and go, all right, well, here's all the beach access. This means this beach is going to be busy. And if you're trying to do what I'm doing, which is to cut people out of pictures, that's not the beach you want to go to. You want to go to the beach that has a hard access or a very narrow access. You know, find a quiet beach, an undisturbed beach. And undisturbed, of course, meaning doesn't have tracks all over it, doesn't have trash all over it, that there's maybe only one or two people out there at sunrise. Okay, great, something like that. But plan it. This is a good time to sit down and look at all these. This is also a good time to start patronizing your local museums and aquariums. You may have seen and say, oh, there's a science museum around. I wonder what they have there. Okay, go check it out. It's cold out today. Don't really want to be outside today, so you find the one that you can go inside and go look at your local attractions and see what happens to be there. Great thing. Just make up a list of all these little things that you're going to do someday. And keep this someday list handy. And then when you're sitting there and you're bored and you haven't taken photos in a while, like me, you can go, oh, let's look at the someday list and see what's happening with it. And go, oh, yeah, this is a good time to do it. Or no, that's one that's got to be in the spring when things are coming into bloom. But this is, again, a planning thing. You've looked at the conditions and you say, oh, you know, just as the apple blossoms come out, that would be a good time to be there. Well, that's a very narrow window of time. So you can say that usually occurs somewhere around here. On that weekend that they're going to come in bloom, that's when I'm going to take off and get to this, because I'm not going to get that opportunity to see this until next year. So you're already planned ahead of time. You already know you have a 200-kilometer drive to get there or something like that. Maybe not that far. Let's say, oh, yeah, 70-kilometer drive. You have a 70-kilometer drive to get to see this particular thing. So you kind of plan and you go, the blossoms should be coming up then. I should be ready to go early in the morning. I should have these camera settings. I should have a picnic lunch and all this. And it's not that I don't have any problem with doing impulsive trips. I don't think there's a bad thing about that. But if you decide on an impulsive trip a little bit too late in the day and then you've got a long drive to get out there, well, then you don't really get the chance to do it. So planning this ahead of time is a very good time to go out and say, oh, yeah, this is going to work well. And it does not hurt to have some contingency plans, have a couple of things planned, because the weather may not cooperate. When you make contingencies, you have options that are available. You know, you say, all right, I've always wanted to go out and see this particular set of bluffs or waterfalls or something, and I want to see it when it's in freezing conditions. Okay, fine. You also, at the same time, or you want to see it, you know, when the blossoms are coming up, when there's a very narrow window. All right, that's fine. But the narrow window comes up and the weather's crap. It's raining like hell out. Oh, all right. Well, now I've got the museum. Now I've got the indoor thing that I can do at the same time. And I think you'll find when you start messing around with these that you will find enough things to do and you are not going to be as productive and you're not going to have as many blog posts as you might have in the summer. But you will still have some things that you can put up and some things of interest. I say, as I haven't had any real posts of interest, and I'm not doing these things right now. Do as I say, not as I do. Once again, I try and give people ideas, but also, you know, sometimes, and this will occur to everybody, you know, other things take place that kind of interrupt and that don't allow you to do some of this. And that's pretty much where I've been at right now. I've had a lot of other things I've been trying to tackle, but I'll get something up. I'll get some more posts up, so calm down. All right, hopefully that gives you an idea and that gives you some things to add to a list and start working on and to be able to produce something. So for the next month, there you go. Go take a look, get that camera bag cleaned, sort some of the photos, and have a list of some odds and ends to do or experiment with. I'm going to be checking back with you and see how well you've done. Until then, I'm Al Dentalspec, and this is Walkabout.